Ladies and gentlemen, this is the current federal tax developments here for the week of September 12, 2016. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated and your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and I'll be your host this week for the updates here on current federal taxes. And it's been an interesting week in federal taxes. We've had a lot of things happen. Started out just a little over a week ago when the IRS gave us a notice regarding preparers whose systems were taken over, 24 cases the IRS has become aware of ID thieves taking over preparer systems to file returns on behalf of the preparer's clients that have happened now. So the IRS has some warnings out with regard to that. We'll also talk about some other cases of interest this week, including an attempt by a taxpayer to creatively use Section 1234 Cap A, a section you might not know a whole lot about, but it didn't turn out to work. We also have a taxpayer who discovered how many years of penalties they'd get clipped with when they overfunded their IRA. We've also had a couple of issues here dealing with TEFRA. We still have TEFRA partnership issues, and we're going to still be dealing with those issues even now. So we'll get ourselves started this week and take a look at some of these neat new things that are happening here in the area of federal taxes. But coming up, we do have the courses that are going to be coming up by the state societies here in the month of October. I'll be heading to Cleveland. So I'll be there the first week of October, October 5th, 6th, and 7th. I'll be doing a set of courses in Cleveland, Ohio. I'll be doing a fringe benefits course on October 5th. So that'll talk about fringe benefits taxation of foreign employees, a course which, if you're in either industry or public accounting, is of interest because payroll is something everybody has to deal with. And October 6th, I'll have a course on the multi-state taxation of business. That can be a very significant case, especially with the Colorado decision we had earlier this year regarding whether or not entities that sell into a state could still have to give reports to that state about who bought from them, who lives in that state, even if the company does not have to collect tax for that state. We'll talk also on October 7th, I'll have a full-day course on preparing Form 1041. After the October 15th filing deadline, Don Cochran is going to be doing 2 days in Rapid City, South Dakota. He'll be talking about the income taxation of trusts and estates, and also then October 18th, depreciation, repairs, and fixed assets. And so that again in South Dakota. In Coralville, Iowa, which is just outside of Iowa City and just a little ways away from Cedar Rapids, Don Cochran will be teaching on October the 20th, assisting the survivors of a decedent's estate. So if you have, you know, you want to get some training, you want to understand how to help your clients, especially as we now approach the tax planning season for the upcoming tax for the, you know, for our 2016 tax returns, now's the time to look at signing up at your state society's website and going ahead and picking up some courses to get yourself in the proper position moving forward. With that, let's go ahead and take a look at our first development this week. This looks at IRS News Release 2016-119, issued on September the 2nd. This is a warning. The IRS, we've talked about this before, the IRS indicating that they believe that ID thieves are going to be targeting preparer systems in order to try to take them over to use those systems to file returns. And the IRS now told us this week they have become aware of about 24 systems that have been taken over by identity thieves of various preparers. This is an obvious sort of thing that was going to be coming. We kind of knew this would happen because as the IRS gets better at, you know, identifying fraudulent returns, getting better at figuring out what returns are probably returns that represent something that shouldn't be allowed, the identity thieves need to have returns, need to be able to file returns that look more legit. The best way to make a return look legit is to take over the account of a preparer who has been filing returns for the last 20 years, so it looks perfectly acceptable that there should be electronically filed returns coming from that account. The IRS warning specifically dealt with the fact that in some of these cases, what's happened is they've compromised remote access software. That remote access software can be the software you're using. It could also be the software that maybe your IT person's using to get into your system. They just need a way in. Once they have their way in, then they would use your tax software to file returns for your clients. That even makes it doubly good because these returns are ones that have previously been filed from this account. You need to take great care to make sure you've locked down any remote access. You need to double and triple check how it's being handled. You've got to make triple sure that nobody in your office is reusing any passwords if you have any sort of way of getting in. That includes not just if you're going to be using something like Windows Remote Desktop. By the way, if you are, please make sure that has been very carefully configured. I would certainly suggest your IT people move that off of the default port. It doesn't help. In one sense, scanning ports isn't that difficult. And number two, it's a lot easier for the bad guys to scan the same port on lots of systems than to exhaustively scan ports on every system. So it actually probably is some, not great, but some security to move you off the default port. As well, make sure that no password reuse is there. If you are using third-party solutions like GoToMyPC or LogMeIn, you need to also check and make sure those systems, that people are not reusing passwords, that it's secured down. Check to see what your IT person is doing. If your IT person is using, you know, a password, you've got the same exposure there if they get in your system. Also consider tying down your attack software. Make sure your software, make sure you have complex logins to get into your software. Don't make it just simply if somebody gets in the door and they get in a system, they'll be able to file returns. You need to consider you have multiple layers of defense. We're going to expect this to get worse as the tax season continues and as we go on. Again, as the IRS gets better at identifying fraudulent returns that these people file in their own systems, they're going to start looking to take over your systems. Of key importance, be very, very, very leery of any link you find in any email, even if it's a link in an email that makes sense to you. I can tell you many times I've gotten a couple of emails in the past couple of weeks, one of which was an actual phishing expedition, and it made sense to have that clicked link, to click that link. Had I done so, happen to know this because I know other people who did on this particular phishing expedition, luckily none in my office, it would have taken over the machine, it would have emailed the same phishing link out to everybody in my address book, and it would have obviously done some other nastiness to my system. The catch is, we don't know quite what, but it wouldn't be good. Be very, very, very careful. Be very leery of any links and emails. Do not click links and emails. It's about the only safety valve we can get. Nevertheless, you've got to have security training, and you need to train your staff. You need both good physical security, good internal, good technological security, and you need to have good security in the nature of people just not doing things, understanding how they could be phished. None of those by themselves can block these. You have to have all of them. And anybody who thinks they can get by and just let the IT people take care of this, those are the ones that are going to get phished. Like it or not, those are the ones that are going to end up losing. They're going to end up losing control of their system. So be very, very careful with that. With that, let's go on to a little more traditional tax document here. This is Technical Advice Memorandum 2016-33022. This was issued on August the 19th, 2016. Now, this is a technical advice memorandum coming from an exam in the field. And in this particular case, what the agent had, the agent was looking at a doctor. The doctor was involved in a practice. The doctor also had an investment in an outpatient surgery facility. The outpatient surgery facility obviously did some work on the taxpayer's patients. Now, the doctor's interest in that facility, as I said, minority interest, had no direct control. Under the insurance rules, was not allowed to basically refer only to that group. They had to give anybody who they tried to give reference to, they had to give a reference to that person of all the available outpatient surgery locations that would be available for them to use. However, there is an example that was in the regulations that talked about a doctor, you know, a doctor's group that went out and, you know, spun off part of their practice, put that in another entity, which they then claim passive activity from, and so passive activity of income. So the agent thought that he should be able to force this doctor to group his practice with this income flowing from this minor interest in the outpatient surgery facility. The IRS agent was told by the national office in the request for technical advice, the national office ruled that no, take a look at that example in the regs. You'll see it in our write-up. If you go download the write-up again at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, you'll see that, in fact, in that example, it was intentionally structured to be a tax planning document. It was intentionally structured, I should say, to be a tax planning regime. They were intentionally trying to get around the passive activity rules. In this case, the doctor didn't do that. The doctor had no control over this other enterprise. he wasn't splitting out part of his practice. Because there was no tax motivation, the IRSA is, as the memo holds, the IRS is blocked on regrouping there. They have to show tax motivation to regroup. But secondly, they said, even if that wasn't the case, the grouping that the doctor had put together also made economic sense. That's the other requirement for grouping. So the IRS, in essence, the agent, despite the fact this looked like what was in the reg, you know, the differences were big. Notice, that's always a big thing, not just for us, not just for the agent in this case, but, you know, preparers quite often, those of us who are doing tax and advising taxpayers, quite often have the same problem. You know, we need to be very careful. Something that looks kind of like our situation, we take and run with it. Always, always think carefully about what are the differences between the situation that you're looking at, be it a regulation example, be it a court case, what's the differences between that and what you're currently, and what you have right in front of you. And then you have to ask yourself the question, are those differences significant? In this case, the answer is pretty easy. Those differences were significant. And for that reason, the IRS was not able to regroup. Well, the same thing would be true sometimes in cases we see for our clients for a position we'd like to take. The differences are significant. You need to be very careful, you know, running with something just because there are a few facts that look like yours. Next up, this is the case of CRI Leslie LLC et al. Versus Commissioner 147 TC number 8, issued on September the 7th, 2016. Now, this is the case I told you about when we start out today, where we talk about the taxpayer who got a little bit creative on Section 1234A. And what they had a $9.7 million deposit on, you know, they had a buyer, so hopefully they actually thought they had a buyer, for a hotel that they were operating. So they owned this hotel, they were going to sell the hotel building to this buyer. They took $9.7 million in deposits. The buyer was never able to close the sale. So because of that, the deposits were forfeited back to the taxpayer. There's no question of $9.7 million in gain. The question became, was that gain going to be capital gain, or was that gain ordinary income? Well, the taxpayer took a look at Section 1234A and said, I think 1234A makes this a capital asset. Capital gain, I should say. Now, if you take a look at 1234A, because I'm sure a lot of us haven't read that section very often, it tells us that gain or loss attributable to cancellation, lapse, expiration, or the termination of a right or obligation with respect to property, which is a capital asset in the hands of the taxpayer, will be a capital gain. Taxpayer said, well, had the sale gone through, we would have had capital gain. Well, not really. Had the sale gone through, you would have had a 1231 gain. That means the hotel property is not a capital gain asset. If you take a look at 1221, not a capital asset. If you take a look at Section 1221, which is conveniently defined, capital asset defined, so it's got a nice title there, which means it's probably relevant here. It tells us specifically that property used in a trade or business is not a capital asset. Section 1231 tells us that if we have net gains from the sale of 1231 assets, which are depreciable assets and real estate used in a trade or business, then we treat that as if it's a net capital gain. But the tax court said, the ruling doesn't say that this would generate capital gain. If so, this ruling says, you know, this law says it has to be a capital asset. Section 1221A clearly says this is not a capital asset. If this is not a capital asset, then 1234 cap A does not apply. If 1234 cap A does not apply, this is just a gain. Since we didn't sell anything, we certainly didn't sell capital asset, this is simply a gain. This gain is ordinary income. Now, 1234 cap A honestly was passed by Congress many years ago to stop a few abuses where people were trying to forfeit, or not forfeit, but basically abandon certain interests to claim ordinary losses. So Congress reclassified those as capital. You may remember that we saw this particular issue when the tax court visited it quite a while back in the Pilgrim's Pride case. Actually, a couple years ago, they were reversed. You know, but the tax court looked at applying this section, and there they said, well, if abandoning rights was a capital, that would be capital. Then if you abandon the stocks is nothing but rights, so 1234 must be cap A, makes that to ordinary. Nope, they said basically on review, the Fifth Circuit overturned that one. This was trying to look at it the other way from a gain standpoint, and the tax court said, no, this really isn't what this was set up for. So sorry, guys, we're not going to let you have a capital gain in this situation. Next up, we have the IRS private letter only 2016-36-033. This was issued on September the 2nd. The IRS is going to deny a request for an early S corporation re-election. Section 1362, if you terminate your S election, you can't re-elect it until 5 years have passed, unless you can get the IRS's permission. Now, the IRS has rules in the regulations here, Regulation 1.1362-5A. The IRS outlines some basic rules here, and what they say is essentially they would generally grant the request to re-elect within 5 years if one of two things is true. Either we essentially have brand new owners that weren't there when we terminated our S election, or if there was some event, the event that caused the termination was not reasonably within control of the corporation. In this case, the taxpayer in this case had sold his shares in the S corporation to a C corporation. Obviously, having a C corporation owner, unless you make the election to be a Q sub, we're going to end up terminating our S election. Then within the 5 year period, for whatever reason, he bought the shares back from that C corporation. Now he's asking the IRS, you know, can I re-elect early so I can go back to being an S corp? The IRS denied the relief. They denied the relief because they said this doesn't really fall under either one of the categories for which we would grant relief. Remember, the loss of the election was totally within the control of the corporation. Had he, you know, it wasn't like he didn't understand the consequences of selling to the corporation was going to end the S election. When he bought it back, yeah, sure. He, you know, now he's like, well, the sale didn't work out. I should be able to go back. The service, however, said, sorry, we're not going to grant it in that case. You didn't meet the requirements of the reg. Now, honestly, this seems a bit harsh, but it's also fully within the IRS's discretion. And it's also fully in line with the reg. This does suggest that it's highly likely in cases like this, the IRS is not going to be very, shall we say, forgiving unless you can meet the specific requirements of the reg. So be careful there if you lose S status as to how what you end up doing. Be very careful and also understand if you sell your S corporation and then you buy it back, you might have trouble getting back to S status until you wait for 5 years from the date that you had the loss of status due to the C corp ownership. Next up, we have another S corp case. This is the case of Scott Singer Installations Inc. versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2016-161, issued on August the 24th of 2016. This particular case involved a taxpayer, which is like some of those that we have, who advanced money to the S corporation and maybe wasn't the best at documenting things, but he did actually put in his, he recorded on the books as loans to the company. Now, we come a few years later, he's receiving payments back out, and he took no salary. The IRS is trying to reclassify those payments as salary. The taxpayer claims they're repaying the loans. Now, the S corporation had been struggling, but in the early years when Scott Singer advanced it money, the company looked like it could be profitable, and he was financing growth. Then 2008 hit. This was a real estate organization, and obviously in 2008, things went bad. And for Scott Singer Installations, things went very bad. And it began to look like, in fact, it was hemorrhaging cash. Commercial lenders would not even consider lending to him. He basically took draws on personal credit cards. He got money from relatives and put that into the corporation. The tax court said, well, you know, he did record these as loans, and it's facts and circumstances that kind of tell us whether we have a loan or not. The court found that the key thing to being a loan, because he documented as a loan, he always recorded as a loan, the key issue that we had to show was, did he have a reasonable expectation of repayment when he made the loan? In this case, the court found prior to 2008, he did have that reasonable expectation of repayment. That, you know, the corporation was growing, it appeared like it would be profitable. Therefore, there's no problem. We can go ahead and we can get, you know, those, any repayments on those would be repayments of loans. After 2008, the tax court said, with no reasonable prospect of repayment. The company is just, you know, hemorrhaging cash. No commercial lender would loan to him. No reasonable person would loan to this organization. That had to be a capital contribution. The good news for Scott was that his repayments were not more than what he had advanced for the payments that the tax court agreed were loans. Therefore, no adjustment for Scott. Makes some sense when you think about it, because had he actually been repaid some of the other, that might have been evidence that it wasn't unreasonable to expect to be repaid. It is important, though, to take a look at this and understand, you know, the analysis the court went through in determining what was considered to be a loan and what wasn't a loan. It's also interesting that this was a case of the IRS trying to pick up salary on an S corporation that was clearly losing money. So you need to be careful there. Don't just assume because the corporation is losing money, we don't have a problem. We can still have a problem with having having compensation issues. Next up, we have a taxpayer who didn't quite understand the rules here. This is Wu versus United States, 118 AFTR 2nd, paragraph 2016, 5154. This is a decision of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals issued on August the 29th of 2016. In this case, a taxpayer had severely over-contributed to his IRA. For reasons that aren't explained in the case, he had got all the proceeds. He and his wife got all these proceeds, over 200 grand, from the sale of their home, and they put all of it into the IRA. Not sure why they thought that was okay, but about 3 years later, they discovered it wasn't. They withdrew the money, and they paid the 6% excise tax on overcontributions. But they did withdraw the money in the early part of 2010, before April 15th of 2010. Now, basically, when we take a look at that part of the rule, under the law, what ends up happening there is that we have all of these neat little issues. The issue there is if you withdraw an overcontribution of an IRA before April 5th, before the due date of the return, then the overcontribution tax doesn't apply. Well, the court said, Mr. Wu, that talks about an overcontribution made during the year. You did not make an overcontribution in 2009. You'd made it many years earlier. You didn't get it out by the first year. If you didn't get it out by the first year, that provision doesn't apply anymore. So it's going to apply for every year. This particular year, we're looking at 2009, and they were protesting. They had filed a claim for refund. They paid the penalty, then asked for a refund for it, and filed the claim for refund. The court said that's not going to apply. 2009 still counts. You essentially have it over-contributed. You didn't withdraw it, so it was there at the end of 2009. You owe the penalty. You must withdraw it before the due date of the year when the initial contribution was made. That's what this particular relief provision is. It doesn't help you later on. That's always a kind of a problem if taxpayers do that, you know, getting over-contributed. So it's a technical issue, but it's kind of an interestingly important technical issue. Next up in our final case for this week, we're going to take a look at a TEFRA case. And as the court tells us, of course, remember, TEFRA is going away, so it'll be a short term. And the court decided this on a very narrow ground. But this is McNeil versus United States, 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, number 15-8095, issued on September the 6th, 2016. Now, this gentleman was the managing partner of a partnership that had undergone a TEFRA exam. At the partnership level during the exam, he had raised reasonable cause defenses for their position on the return. The IRS had denied that position, and he didn't challenge that at the partnership level. However, when he got his notice of adjustment, he raised reasonable cause yet again. It was effectively the same argument because, remember, he was a managing partner. So you got to kind of figure whatever knowledge he had as managing partner, he had as individual filing the return using the K-1. So in theory, it appears to be basically the same argument. Can he argue it again? The IRS in court and the district court had decided he couldn't argue it because they said TEFRA doesn't let you relitigate things that are partnership items and decided at the partnership level. The 10th Circuit panel, we have a 2-1 split in the panel here. The 10th Circuit panel found, essentially the majority, two of the three, said, well, the problem here is, you know, you only raised the question of did TEFRA block this by itself. TEFRA allows partners to raise partner-level defenses. It very much reasonable cause could very well be a partner-level defense. Why? Because maybe the partner didn't understand what was happening. The partner thought it was all good. They sought out advice. They could have acted reasonably. The fact that this guy was a managing partner, per the law in TEFRA, didn't matter, the majority ruled. Rather, it was, you know, he would be allowed to raise reasonable cause defense. Now, the opinion strongly suggests that the service actually raised the question that this would be a retrial of the same issues. There's no factual difference, and this had already been decided, that under the judicial doctrine, you could have very well gotten a different result. That judicially, we might be able to say, no, this has already been argued. But the statute, they're arguing very narrowly, the statute does not demand that this, the managing partner, be blocked from reasonable cause defense. The dissenting opinion effectively said, yes, it does, if in fact the reasonable cause defense he's asserting is identical to the defense that was already decided at the partnership level, unless he brings something new to the table, which he's not bringing. Realistically, we should just say you can't relitigate what was already decided at the partnership level. You've got to have a different defense. So, interesting case, but as the majority said, in a couple of years, this kind of goes away. Basically, it's going to cease to be a problem since everything would be at the partnership level, at least by default under the new rules. But for the next few years, and actually for a few years after that, we're still going to have these TEFRA cases. It's an interesting case from that standpoint. Maybe not one that you're actually going to spend a lot of time with, I understand. But still, interesting case looking at the, perhaps, and honestly, I think the real decision was that the IRS simply put all its eggs in one basket, didn't argue the right point, and that was kind of what the majority was talking about. Well, make sure you join your fellow CPA. Say one of the neat things about live training is you get coffee, you get the breakfast, you know, you get all these neat things, you get the lunch, you can basically have your coffee and your croissants or whatever, muffins, whatever you might be having. I notice most CPAs don't go for the fruit. When I was in Cedar Rapids this week, the person at the hotel who was, you know, on the break getting rid of the stuff that was out set out for everybody and coming back, commented that all the fruit was still there, but all the muffins were gone. Kind of fun way of looking at that. So I know how we do this, but you still have your coffee. We're CPAs, we like coffee. So go ahead, make sure you check your state CPA Society catalogs. We're getting into the tax planning part of the season. Once we get past October 15th, we're going to be doing all those nice year-end trainings. Be sure to check your society's calendars. Your society's calendars will tell you all the neat programs they've got. We've got a bunch of them here. Be sure to check ours here at Nichols Patrick. But the state societies also have a whole bunch from all the providers. So be sure you take a look. There's a lot of good offerings there. Be sure to sign up. This has been the current federal tax developments for the week of September 12, 2016. Be sure to catch our daily updates at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also download a PDF with articles with all today's topics on the weekly update page. If you have any questions or comments, send them to me at edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at edzollers. And I look forward to seeing you next week. If this week sounds a little weird, I'm actually broadcasting this from the Holiday Inn at the Newark Airport. I'm here for some meetings this week, so I have to do something here off here at the hotel. But so I apologize if the sound's not the greatest or the video's a little bit different, but we'll get back to doing it the regular way next week, and I hope to see you next week.